Well, good morning. It's Palm Sunday, and I got to be honest with you, I kind of feel like that snuck up on us. Just came out of nowhere, but we're still ready. We're prepared, and we're ready to celebrate. And today, even though we probably won't be looking at this classic Palm Sunday passage, the triumphal entry, I think, as we look at the seventh and really final miracle before Easter, it's going to set things up well for next week. And so I'm excited to dive into that, into our Better Jesus Is series, and see the seventh and really final miracle in John's gospel. Before we get started, though, there's actually another holiday this week. There's another holiday before even Friday. It's opening day. Opening day, one of the greatest holidays around. And those of you who know me know that I'm a huge Dodgers fan. I grew up going to games with my dad and my brother, and honestly, 2020 wasn't all bad because the Dodgers finally won that World Series we had been waiting for. And we go to games, and we experience this, and I think kind of what I realize is, you know, people often, I think, as they go to things more, they kind of find their area. They find their seat in church, or they find their spot in the stadium they like. But when it comes to baseball games, I realize I actually kind of like moving around different times I go. And I think the reason is because they give you different perspectives depending on where you're sitting. The first one, and this is just everyone's favorite, it's the ball, it's like called the ballpark club, I believe. It's like right behind, dugout club. It's right behind home plate, or it's right behind the dugout. I mean, those are the up-close personal seats. And from there, you just have this really close, tight perspective of the game. You can hear the ball, or you can see the ball just zip past you. You can hear the pop of the glove, the crack of the bat. And sometimes you're so close that you can actually interact with the players and feel like you're part of the experience. You know, you can get the autographs. You can eavesdrop in as they are making their dinner plans for after the game. You're really in close, and you're part of the experience. One thing, though, is that's only one perspective of the game. And as amazing as it is, it's actually a little bit limited in a sense, because if you move just a few sections up, you get a whole different perspective of the game. You can see things that you weren't able to see before, diving plays in the outfield, home runs, strategy happening behind the scenes. You get now a much wider perspective of what's going on. And see, I bring this up because as we dive into the miracle today, I want you to hold on to this idea of perspective, because I think perspective is going to play a pretty significant role in the miracle. See, today we're looking, as I said, into this final miracle that happens before Easter, and it's the miracle of Lazarus. And in this miracle, no one really expected Jesus to do what he was going to do until it happened. Jesus was the only one who had this much wider, larger perspective of his authority, and he could see what was going on before it was. So, if you will, turn to John chapter 11. That's where we're going to be today. But for time's sake, I'm going to just like kind of catch us up to where we're going to be in our passage, because we're going to skip a few verses in. And so this miracle of Lazarus, it kind of happens a little bit early than where we're diving in. And for those of you who don't know, Lazarus, he's kind of most well known for being the brother of Mary and Martha. And so this is a family that's actually pretty well connected to Jesus. They love him. He loves them. Mary and Martha both kind of get other stories in the Bible, and so we know this is a family that Jesus is connected to. Well, that's the story. Right before it happens, Jesus, he's away. He's teaching with his disciples, and all of a sudden, he gets a message. A messenger appears, and he gives Jesus just a really short, simple, yet heavy message, and it's just this: Lord, the one who you loved has fallen ill. And it's amazing how in such a small phrase, so much can be learned. Because just in that small phrase, we see already that clearly this is actually a big deal. Lazarus doesn't have a runny nose or some allergies. This has to be a life-threatening thing if he's going to be needing a messenger to reach Jesus. But I think also what's interesting is we get that glimpse into the relationship they have. Because if you'll see in the message, it's a one-liner, and in that one line, first and foremost, they tell us as the readers that this is a family that's close to Jesus, and we also know that because they don't actually request Jesus to do anything. They don't tell him, hey, come at once. You need to come. Lazarus is sick, he's dying, all they say is they alert him of the problem. And then in a sense, they kind of step back and hope and expect that Jesus' love will move him towards them. What's interesting, though, and what's often sometimes hard for us is that Jesus doesn't immediately go back to Lazarus right away. He doesn't hear that message and then immediately turn and go back to Judea. He doesn't change what he's doing. He actually stays where he is for another 2 days. But this isn't apathy from Jesus. This is Jesus having a much wider perspective than everyone else in the story. And so Jesus is doing this intentionally. And after waiting by design 2 more days, he now alerts his disciples, okay, it's time. I hope you're ready because now we're going back. And I think this caught the disciples by surprise because they had an even different perspective than everyone else. They thought, oh, Jesus isn't going back because that's where the opposition is. We're not going back because that's danger. Let's stay out here where it's safe and teach and talk to people and do our own miracles over here. But if we go back there, there's trouble. And so they're uneasy when Jesus says, it's time to go back and see Lazarus. It's time to go back to Judea. And it's only until Thomas, a.k.a. Doubting Thomas, rallies the troops and kind of gets everyone on and ready and ready to move forward. And to me, I think that's kind of interesting because it's the disciple who is famous for doubting that encourages all the other disciples to have faith and trust in Jesus to go into certain danger. So I don't know. That's just something for us to maybe hold on to. We won't dive into it this week, but I think there's something there for us to be looking at. Well, they head back and they make their way to Judea. And as they do, for us, the readers, I think what is John's goal is he's trying to build in us this feeling that there's something big going on. He's trying to let us know this is more than the other miracles leading up to it. Yes, we've seen Jesus heal people. Yes, we've seen Jesus supernaturally change the weather, even walk on water. But now he's going up against an opponent that's taking it to the next level. Because in this miracle, Jesus isn't just healing someone. He's going toe-to-toe with death. And for the first time ever, really, the grave is meeting someone who is its match. And so join with me, if you will. We're going to be in John 11, now 17, verse 17. So we're skipping ahead. And that's where we pick up. And it says, when Jesus arrived, he found Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. So he'd already been dead for 4 days. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Mary and Martha to counsel them and to sit with them. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met with him while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection of the last day. Different perspective. They're talking about two different things. And Jesus said to him, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming to the world. Okay, I'm going to stop right there for a moment because I think in the lead up from before these first 17 verses and now in these verses, we get our kind of first point of what's going on in this story. And this first point is that Jesus is at work, even when it's not the way that we expect it. So Jesus is at work in this story, but it's just different than how Martha or Mary later on expected Jesus to work. Because they sent a messenger to him, and while they didn't ask for anything, they definitely had expectations. They definitely had expectations at mind, and Jesus didn't do things the way they expected, but as we are seeing now, he's still at work. But you can tell from Mary's response when she first sees Jesus, there's a bit of disappointment in her voice. You can see that these missed expectations have set in. In verse 21, she said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And so Martha's disappointed. I mean, she's seen for her own eyes and heard countless miracles and healings that Jesus has done. But now, when it comes time for her, all she's left is with a what if. What if Jesus had been here? And I think, truthfully, this is important that it's in the story, because I think we often experience some of these what-if moments. You know, we feel, what if God had done this? What if God had done this that I expected or that I asked for, or like he did for my friends or like he did for these people? What if God acted in this way that I thought? And Martha had a set expectation of how Jesus would get it done. So when he doesn't meet that set expectation, you can see this disappointment set in. But I think perspective is part of the reason that this disappointment is coming in, because perspective is playing a pretty significant role. See, Jesus and Martha, they're viewing things on two completely different levels. Now, I don't know how many of you probably in this room, but hopefully some of you watching and here have seen the show WandaVision. WandaVision is a show, it just came out, it's about two Marvel superheroes living in the suburbs. And somehow, this took our entire culture by storm. You couldn't go a day without seeing some sort of post or story or YouTube video talking about the show. It just perplexed our whole culture. And I think the reason that it did was because everyone was trying to gain some perspective on what was going on. There was a mystery at play, and people wanted to get some insight. So much so that people, knowing that the creators of the show like to hide these little Easter eggs or small details within that you can't really see, people decided to watch the show again in quarter speed or half speed. And so they would write these articles that were like, hey, I watched WandaVision in a quarter speed, and here's everything you missed. And I just thought that was funny, because first of all, I don't know if we were meant to see all those things, but secondly, who has time to watch an hour-long show in a quarter speed? That sounds crazy to me. But they did it because they wanted to gain a much larger perspective of what was going on. See, Martha, she's experiencing this miracle take place at full speed. All she knows and all she sees is what she had experienced before and what she sees right here in front of us. And I think this is usually where we are too when we are experiencing these what-if moments. Our perspective is limited to what we know and also what's going on right here in front of us. Jesus, though, he's operating on a whole different level. And because of that, he's actually been at work this whole entire time. He's been at work in this miracle even from the beginning, even when he decided to wait and become and make sure that he was late. Oswald Chambers once said, sometimes it looks like God is missing the mark because we're too short-sighted to see what he's aiming for. Jesus is at work. He's at work in this miracle, and he's at work now, even if it's not the ways that we expected. Before moving on with the passage, I just want to do like a really quick tangent, because I think it's in here and I think it's important, so bear with me. I think we need to pause for a moment and give Martha actually some serious credit here. I know we're kind of using her to learn for ourselves, but we need to stop and give Martha some serious credit in this passage, because even though she was disappointed and even though she was experiencing missed expectations, she still gives one of the best theological statements of any of Jesus' followers in the New Testament. I mean, she gives an amazing statement of faith in the midst of her pain. She affirms not only that God is at work with Jesus, they're going together to make their plan happen, but also that her brother will rise again one day. Not immediately, but one day with Jesus. And most of all, in verse 27, she says, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming to the world. So she affirms Jesus' identity. I think this is amazing, especially because Martha is a character that we often just associate with the busy house guest. We only think of that one story where she's too busy to experience Jesus and she's missing out. But in reality, there's a depth to her character. There's a depth to really her understanding and her mature theology of Jesus. A mature understanding of Jesus that I think, honestly, sometimes we wish we had seen in the 12 disciples up until this point. And so I just wanted to stop for a moment and just point out what an inspiration that she was. What an inspiration that in the midst of so much pain and so much disappointment, that she could cling to who Jesus was. All right. Tangent over, can jump back in. Verse 28. Martha told Mary privately, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but he was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in his spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not the one who opened the eyes of the blind have kept this man from dying?" Let's stop right there again for a moment, because I think in this passage we see our second thing, and it's that Jesus sits with us in our pain. Jesus sits with us in our pain. Both Mary and Martha, they respond to this disappointment in a way that I think many of us would. Yet what's so amazing is how Jesus responds to them. Because see, Jesus responds to them with tenderness. He doesn't rebuke them or even express disappointment that they would comment on his absence. Instead, he sits with them in their pain. He gets so invested to the point that he empathizes and he cries with them. Verse 35, Jesus wept, a.k.a. every Awana kid's favorite memory verse, actually has some pretty deep meaning to it. So it's good that the Awana kids are memorizing that verse. I know it's two words, but those two words bring so much depth. What an insight into Jesus' tenderness, into his warmth, into his connection to his people, that he's willing to sit with us in our pain and weep with us. Well, when I was in high school, I had a classmate. His name was Evan. And truth be told, Evan and I weren't like super close friends. We were classmates. We were acquaintances. And we were classmates in our senior year. So we would often talk about, you know, what are you planning next? What's college like? Life after college? Stuff like that. And I think it was through some of those conversations, as well as me constantly wearing a Biola sweatshirt, which I never even went to that school in the end, so you're welcome for the free advertising, Biola. We actually ended up having some conversations just about faith, about going into ministry and church and stuff like that. And even though those conversations were really pretty surface level, it ended up that they had an impact. Because if you flash forward, I don't know, 5 or so years later, I graduated from college and I moved to Palos Verdes. I was working here. All of a sudden, though, I got a random Instagram message from Evan. I didn't even know we followed each other, but there it was. And this message was simple. It just said, "Are you still a Christian? And did you ever become a pastor?" Now, what ended up happening was that Evan had experienced his own moments of pain, of disappointment, of questioning, and he needed someone to talk to. The problem is, he lived close to 2 hours away from me, and like I said, I mean, we were acquaintances, classmates. We didn't really know each other. It had been 5 years, and so when this message came, I got to tell you, just truthfully, there was definitely temptation to ignore it. There was temptation to let just the busyness of life take precedent and to keep on moving. But something kept pulling me back. Something kept making me want to respond. So I finally did, and we exchanged a few messages, and ultimately I drove out there and met with him. And when I did, I packed up my backpack full of books and all sorts of things, because I wasn't sure if I was about to go into like a game show style questioning of all the craziness and hard questions of the Bible, so I wanted to be prepared. But in reality, he just needed someone who could sit in the pain with him and could talk. And so that's what we did. We sat at a coffee shop until they ended up closing and kicking us out. And I think that experience actually taught something to him and something to me that I think changed our lives. Because in that experience, just having someone to sit with him made him want to know more about this community. So much so that he actually drove up here to PCC a few times. He came here on Sunday morning multiple times just looking for this kind of community before ultimately, you know, deciding it's probably better to find something like this a little closer to home rather than always making that drive. And for me, I think it taught me a very valuable lesson that I needed to learn very early on in ministry. And the lesson was that there's something just profoundly healing and profoundly biblical, I think, in being heard. See, Jesus, he knows that he's going to call Lazarus out of the tomb. He knows he's going to flip this whole situation on its head and that everything's going to change. But before he does that, he sits with them in their pain and he mourns with those who are mourning. And I think that's amazing that God incarnate, the creator of the universe, is willing to feel with his people. When we hurt, our creator weeps with us. Not in a sense of hopelessness like we often do, but in a sense of compassion. Jesus is showing us right here that he's not distant. He's intimate. He's not apathetic. He's a God who mourns with us. And so I think these words, these two words, are so profoundly impactful into our relationship with Christ because we see that God is intimate with us. Sometimes, though, you need that friend who can just sit with you in pain. Sometimes you need a friend who can do something, though. And I think in this miracle, we see that Jesus is both. He's that intimate friend that will sit with you, but he's also someone who is capable of doing something. And that's what happens in the next section. Verse 38, it says, "Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and the stone was lying against it. Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, 'Lord, there's already a stench because he's been dead for 4 days.' But Jesus said to her, 'Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?' So they took away the stone. And Jesus looked upward and said, 'Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always heard me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me.' When he had said this, he cried out in a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out.' The dead man came out, his hands, his feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped up in a cloth. Jesus said to him, 'Unbind him and let him go.'" That brings us to our Jesus is of the week. And this one, truth be told, I'm just taking straight from the title of Mark Batterson's book because he said it so well. Jesus is the grave robber. Jesus is the grave robber. Jesus had already displayed his powers of healing, his powers of miraculousness. But until this miracle, he had never revealed his resurrection power. And so Jesus calls out Lazarus, showing that he has the power and authority to not only do the miraculous, but to even have the authority over the grave itself. And so Jesus is showing us that his perspective is not temporal, but it's eternal. And while in this miracle, it should be celebrated that he's doing this, he's actually also trying to help bring us into this perspective. He's trying to foreshadow that there's something even greater than Lazarus' resurrection that's coming, and it's coming just next Sunday. Because Lazarus will someday die again, as all people do, but the resurrection that comes next week, well, that makes this one pale in comparison. Today is Palm Sunday. We know that now. It's the beginning of Holy Week. This is the day normally we celebrate that Jesus rode in victoriously, even though he knew that all those chants and celebrations would turn. And as the week just grows darker and darker, and it comes to Friday where he's falsely accused, he's arrested, he's beaten, and then ultimately crucified, and just experiencing this immense physical pain. He's also just experiencing an immense spiritual pain as well. But John is trying to invite us in. He's trying to show us, as he writes, that this is how God showed his love among us, that he sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. This is not love, that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for us. This miracle right here with Lazarus is a miracle in itself, but it's also a foreshadow. That's a foreshadow of what Christ was about to go through for us. The pain, the physical pain and the spiritual pain that he was committed to because he was committed to us. And I think this miracle doesn't just actually foreshadow Jesus' resurrection, but it also foreshadows ours as well. Because just like Lazarus, Jesus is calling us as well out of the grave. He's robbing us from the grave as well. So I think the challenge is, as we dive into this miracle, as we're reading this miracle, is to just kind of ask ourselves, can we hear him? Can we hear him calling our name? Can we hear him calling us out of sin, calling us out of death, calling us out of the grave? See, Jesus gave Mary and Martha their brother back. Lazarus, he had a second chance at life. And what Jesus did for Lazarus, he also wants to do for us. He also wants to give us life. And I think we see in this miracle that our life, our second life, begins not only when Jesus calls us out of the grave, but like Lazarus, we get up and we go to him. I mentioned that I stole this last Jesus Eve from a guy named Mark Batterson, and he writes about this miracle, and I was tempted not to bring it up, but he writes something that I thought was so amazing, and I think that could bring us kind of into that point of walking out of the grave and back to Jesus. Mark Batterson writes about how Lazarus was just wrapped in grave clothes, and how because of the tradition, it would have been hard for Lazarus to even move. And so when Jesus calls Lazarus out of the grave, what's happening is Lazarus is not only struggling to get up, but he can't really walk. His feet are bound, and so he's hopping his way out of the grave. And so when you see this miracle happen, you just see, almost imagine like a mummy hopping out towards you. And I just love what Mark Batterson says, because he's trying to pull it into us walking out of the grave. He's making a little bit of a joke of it and just saying, I just imagined that all the future dance parties that Mary and Martha and all their friends were doing the Lazarus to remember this time together. And as funny as it is, I think it's true though, right? Can we imitate Lazarus as well? Not just in hopping around and for fun, but in getting out of the grave and going to Jesus. As I close, I just want to read this last story, and it's a pretty famous story, so you may have even heard it before, but it comes from a guy named Bishop Kenneth Ulmer. And he tells the story in his congregation about two people that he knew who had an interaction at a museum. And what happens is that these two people were exploring the museum when they come across a painting of a chess game. And one of the characters in this painting, they look like an ordinary man. But the other one is much scarier looking. The goal of the painter was to kind of make you think of a scarier figure, almost like the devil, an evil one. And this ordinary man, he's down to his last piece. All he has left is a king. And the title of the painting is just Checkmate, kind of to give you the sense of despair of life. Well, the bishop's friends are looking at this painting, and it just so happens that one of his friends is not just a chess player, but an internationally renowned chess player. So he kind of knows what he's doing. And something about this painting just intrigues him. And he makes it known that it's not just because chess was in the painting, but there was something on the board itself that he couldn't get over. And so he just stares at this. He studies it. He gets so engrossed in it that the one who's with him kind of gets a little impatient, as I imagine I would. And so he asks his friend, what are you doing? Why are you so stuck in this painting? And the chess player says, there's something about this painting that bothers me. I want to study it for a while because I often study chess boards and I play games all day, and something about this one just seems off to me. So you know what? You go ahead, you wander off, you go look around, but me, I'm going to stay right here. I'm going to study this for a little bit longer. So as the friend wandered off, the chess player just stayed there, and he kept looking at the painting. And as he did, his hands started to move, and he started to map out the game. He's thoroughly engaged in this painting, so much so that he's been there the whole time, and the friend comes back after seeing everything else. And kind of just having enough, the friend just says, all right, what's up? What's going on? What is so interesting about this painting? Because I've already moved on. And the chess player just says, we need to locate the person who painted this picture. We need to tell them that they need to make a change because they either need to change what's happening in the picture or they need to change the title. I've studied this painting, and I've determined there's something wrong with it. He still doesn't say what it is, and so the friend's like kind of hooked in now. He's like, okay, tell me what's wrong. Like, I don't think we can actually do it, but let's do it. And the chess player just says, well, the title's all wrong. It says checkmate. But that title misreads what's happening on the board, because in reality, the king still has one more move. I think I tell you this story not just because this one right here, Lazarus, is the last miracle in John, but because there's still one more left. And as the story and as our time here kind of moves into Passion Week and ultimately to Good Friday, we see this chessboard look bleaker and bleaker, and things probably from their perspective looked worse and worse. But in reality, as the board starts to look like game over, as it starts to look like checkmate, the king still has one more move. And that move, it's a game-breaking one.